You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
It's great to be here with Jamie Holmes. This is being co-presented with the information program, the Open Society Foundations. Doris Chaplinskas is here from the London office with us. I'm Lenny Bernardo with the Fellowship Program and with the Eurasia Program. It's a great pleasure to be with Jamie because and hi to our London, our DC office, because I feel that the work that we do at the Open Society Foundations is so vested with certainty and rationality and putative clarity and coherence, where means and ends sort of line up with one another. And I think that what Jamie has done quite thoughtfully and prodigiously in his book, Nonsense, which came out in October, is to show very much the advantages of the sort of sometimes paradoxes within notions of ambiguity and uncertainty and ambivalence, which I think is something quite significant for our own thinking, the Open Society Foundations. I will also say that one of the people that blurbed your book, that will again be here in a moment, Cass Sunstein, he did blurb it.
He did.
He's going to be here in a moment?
No, Cass won't be here, unfortunately, but the book will be. hopefully that her stirs will bring down. But, you know, Sunstein has this now... rather dated, but I think that the point holds up thesis about advocacy organizations and the need for a degree of uniformity in thinking, mm-hmm. and a sort of rational approach in which people sign on to a set of arguments or prescriptions, points of view and the like. And for Sunstein, it was quite important for people to achieve a degree of consensus and sort of, or even intellectual uniformity, in order to advance particular goals and objectives, which is in many ways the inverse of the tack taken at the Open Society Foundations, at the Open Society Fellowship at the Open Society Foundations, which is that the degree of ambivalence and sometimes contrarianism is quite significant and important to pushing. Whether it's an advocacy goal or a programmatic objective, that in fact consensus or uniformity or degree of clarity or just non-ambiguity is important, yeah. to push advocacy objectives. And so I think that in many ways your book can tell us a lot about who we are and what we do. And so what I'm going to do is have Jamie give an overview of his thinking on nonsense and how we make sense of it, and then just begin a discussion on what we can, as an institution, learn from his framing. So as you saw in the bio, Jamie is a current Future Tense Fellow at the Numerica Foundation, where he's also worked. His book came out in October. He's working now on a magazine piece on randomized control trials, which is something else that I think a lot of people here have interest in from various fronts. Maybe I wasn't supposed to say that.
No, it's fine.
Okay, so Jamie, over to you.
Thank you so much, Lenny, and thank you all for coming, and thank you, DC. I'm sorry for having notes. I spent the last month emptying my head of nonsense, so I've had to refresh my memory a little bit, but... So in a very academic fashion, I'll just start with definitions. The book is about the psychology of ambiguity. And I define ambiguity as anything that's unclear. So information is missing, contradictory, or complex. And then uncertainty is the mind state of encountering ambiguity. So we feel uncertain. And various disciplines define those two words differently. So I'll be clear up front. The history of the study of the psychology of ambiguity really begins after World War II. There was a Nazi psychologist named Erich Jentsch, and he wrote this book in 1938. It's called The Antitype, Der Gegentypus. And he said that the tolerance of ambiguity is what characterizes the unhealthy mind. And the healthy mind is really characterized by certainty and clarity and so forth. So psychologists after World War II were trying to figure out, you know, the psychology of this horrid, horrible event. And so out of that and reversing Jentsch, comes Elsa Frankel Brunswick, who's a psychologist in California, and of course Adorno. And she had a scale which was going to measure the intolerance of ambiguity. And she suggested that actually the intolerance of ambiguity is what characterized the unhealthy mind. And of course, in Adorno's, in The Authoritarian Personality, which he was a co-author on, they actually have a scale called the F scale, which stood for fascist. Out of that comes a series of competing scales. And the central concept of the book is one of these scales. It's called the Need for Closure scale. I think it's the best one. There are others, and I list them all in the end notes. It was developed by a social psychologist named Aryeh Kruglansky. He's at the University of Maryland. He developed in the 80s, and then the scale comes out in 1993. And Kruglansky's view is a little different than Adorno's and of other scales. He said, instead of pathologizing this need for clarity, this need for certainty, what if it's something very deeply rooted in the human psychology? And that in certain contexts, when we're under pressure, it becomes raised. And that one of the results of that could be stereotyping and these negative effects stem from that. So that's his theory. He defines need for closure as a desire for a definite answer on some topic, any answer, as opposed to confusion and ambiguity. And he says this comes from our need to manage complexity and our need to act in the world. There's a great quote by a psychologist named Jordan Peterson, and he says, the need to manage complexity looms above all other psychological concerns. And Kruglansky likewise says, if we didn't have a mechanism to close our mind, really this is about open and closed-mindedness, we would never act. So there has to be something that's pushing us to resolve contradictions in order to act, and that's the need for closure. I listed just some examples of the scale so you all can get a feel for what it measures. It's a self-report measure. It was originally 42 questions. There's a 15-question version of it. I have five of these questions. If you want to rate yourself on it, it's a scale from 1 to 6. 1 is strongly disagree, and 6 is strongly agree. So there's 5 of these. I feel comfortable when I don't understand why an event occurred in my life. I dislike questions which could be answered in many different ways. I don't like to go into a situation without knowing what I can expect from it. When I have made a decision, I feel relieved. I find that establishing a consistent routine enables me to enjoy life more. So 5 questions, 6-point scale. The lowest possible score is 5 in this mini version, unscientific version, and the highest is 30. If you have a low need for closure, 5 to 16, here's the kind of the attributes that are associated with that. When you're thinking over a problem, you try to consider as many sides of an issue as possible. You don't mind being wrong as much as most people do. You're more likely to change your mind. In social conflicts, you often see both sides' grievances as partially justified. You like trying new things out. And you'd make a great negotiator. You're well-suited for dealing with a changing business environment. This is kind of the fun version. I'll give you a little more serious version in a second. If you have a high need for closure, you make decisions quickly. You believe that having clear rules and order at work is essential to success. You may stick to familiar friends. Ultimately, the way to think of a high need for closure is that it's not always bad, but it means you're more quickly likely to jump to a viewpoint. If it's a viewpoint you agree with, that could be great. But it really is describing how quickly you're trying to get out of a contradiction or an uncertainty or an ambiguity. What I find really interesting about the need for closure is that it's not just a static personality trait. So it began as an investigation of an individual personality variable, and then they started to test the situational factors which affect it. So it turns out that we become less comfortable with ambiguity when we're rushed. There's a time limit. When we're bored, when we're tired, actually alcohol makes us less tolerant of ambiguity. And we're not generally aware of these ebbs and flows. So what Jablonski is really describing is, you know, this up and down, more open-minded, more closed-minded over the course of a day, over the course of a week, a month. And that matters, because a high need for closure is negatively associated with a number of judgments. Being inflexible in the face of threats, who you decide to trust, whether you admit you're wrong, whether you stereotype, and it even is related to creativity, a lack of creativity. So a lot of the book is about this construct, about guarding against the high need for closure, strategies to lower your need for closure, and then, as you say, in what ways can ambiguity be used to help us be more creative. So there's two parts of this, of having a high need for closure. One is urgency and the other is permanence. And both are about getting out of a contradiction, getting out of the feeling of uncertainty more quickly. So there's the linchpin study that Kruglansky did is he told subjects, okay, pretend you're part of a jury. You're going to go in, you're going to argue with another subject. This was actually a Confederate working for him. And you're going to debate a case. An airline had crashed. It burned some timber in a forest, and the timber company was suing the airliner. Now, Kruglansky made some people feel certain and some people feel uncertain before they went in. He did this by giving them expert opinions in favor of either the lumber company or the airline company. The trick of the experiment was, in some cases, they had a noisy printer in the background. Just a slight irritant, a slight stressor. When the printer wasn't there, the pairs agreed at about 5 minutes. It didn't really make much of a difference if they were certain or not going in. When the printer was there, it kind of polarized how fast it took to agree. So if you were uncertain, you agreed much more quickly with the Confederate, about 3.5 minutes. If you went in with an idea of who was right or wrong, it took you much longer or you didn't agree, so about 6.5 or 7 minutes. So in both cases, you're escaping the feeling of uncertainty that's caused by this debate. In one case, it's by deference. In the other case, it's by denial. What I find really interesting is how subtle some of these stressors can be. That you can think of being bored or rushed or being tired as a mental conflict, right? I have to do something, but I'm tired. That's a mental conflict. I'm bored, but you're making me, you know, judge something. But they can be actually really, really subtle. So there's some very cool experiments that show how sensitive we are to nonsense or contradictions or anomalies. In one study, they flashed these words on the stream on a screen: turn frog, quickly blueberry. These are nonsense phrases. After seeing these, people express their beliefs more strongly. I think in this case it was they expressed nationalism more strongly than they normally would.
To the blueberry one.
That's right. And they didn't notice it. So these were flashed very quickly. And the reason the psychologists are doing that is because they don't want you to resolve it. They want the contradiction to still be lingering there, which, of course, many contradictions in our lives are like. They do linger. Reversed playing cards, they played, you know, blackjack or whatever, and they had reverse color cards, and they had red spade cards, and so forth. Again, people didn't notice, and again, it made you, if you believed that social inequality was unjust, it made you express greater support for affirmative action than you normally would. I suspect, and I don't argue this explicitly in the book, that this is one of the contributors to political polarization. And you see this a little more explicitly in a series of studies. So last year, 2014, they did an investment game at a business school, and you had to transfer a certain amount of money to someone else who was playing the game. They could transfer it back. When you give it to them, it triples. So it's a trust game. How much are they going to send back to you? They said, okay, there's two
scenarios. In one scenario, you're transferring money to a friend. In another scenario, you're transferring money to a stranger. When the need for closure was not elevated, it didn't matter if the person was a friend or a stranger. When they were under time pressure, it polarized how much money they committed. So much more to the friend and much less to the stranger. There's a really fun study, which I like a lot, which is they made subjects feel a lack of control, and then they saw whether they would express, or they did express, greater faith in God or Darwin's theory of evolution as long as Darwin's theory was presented as predictable. So this is content-free. This is some anomaly, and I'm moving towards meaning. I'm trying to reestablish an order in some way. It doesn't have to be even related to the anomaly, what I'm affirming. After being reminded of death, which is actually the easiest way to get an experimental effect in social psychology, is to remind people of death. It's the ultimate anomaly. People who had authoritarian views were more likely to criticize an immigrant than they normally would be, than like-minded subjects who hadn't received such a reminder. And the same for liberals. The positive effects of the immigrant go up. So you get the idea. One psychologist who I interviewed said he speculates that these compensatory attempts, and it's not just affirmation, there are a few other ways we do this, compensatory attempts to reestablish meaning after experiencing some form of ambiguity, contradiction, anomaly, may account for up to 60% of human behavior. And at the far end is extremism. So Kruglansky has looked at extremists in Morocco, Northern Ireland, Palestine, and Spain, Sri Lanka, and he found that there's two attributes that define them. One is that this gave them some sense of purpose, but the other was a high need for closure and shutting out anything that contradicted them. In group settings, as in an organization, it becomes even harder to stick up for ambiguity. Intuitively, that makes sense. Can't say it's harder to say I don't know when you're in a group. But in group settings, when they've done experiments on this and they raise people's need for closure, they put them under pressure in some way, group members who deviate from the consensus are more quickly marginalized. There is an experiment in 2003. Groups under a high need for closure adopt more dictatorial decision-making styles. They favor autocratic leaders who tend to dominate the discussion. So in organizations that deal with a lot of ambiguity, like, let's say, intelligence analysis, you really want to isolate people who are comfortable with ambiguity, who are going to be flexible, who are not going to jump to conclusions, who are going to be able to change their minds. Okay, so I'll pivot from kind of protecting against the pitfalls of ambiguity under a high need for closure and say, well, when can it be useful? When do we like it? The first answer is, unsurprisingly, it depends on the context. So the ambiguity of whether or not I might get fired is just much more threatening than the ambiguity that I might see at MoMA. You know, at MoMA, it's I don't have to act.
So Museum of Modern Art.
Museum of Modern Art. Okay. So a contemporary art museum. I don't have to act. There's no consequences. I don't have to evaluate anything. So if you think of all the contexts where we really enjoy ambiguity, they're all safe, low need for closure contexts for most of them. Poetry, detective stories, crossword puzzles. The way I think about it, and it's borrowed from a psychologist, Tim Wilson and Dan Gilbert, is that uncertainty, the mind state of uncertainty, amplifies the emotions of whatever it is we're thinking about. So cool studies on this very quickly. It's more pleasurable to think you're going to not be sure you're going to get one gift or two gifts than it is to know you're going to get two gifts for sure. Same is true in romance in an experimental context. It was more exciting for people to be unsure whether someone liked them a moderate amount or a lot than to know for sure that the person liked them a lot. It shows you that we're just trying to resolve, and if it's pleasurable, it's amplifying that pleasure. But even when ambiguity is jarring, initially jarring or unpleasant or under a high need for, it's threatening, it can still be a fuel for creativity. and one of the fundamental sources of creativity, if not the, isolated by psychologists, is called diversifying experiences. That's a term used by the psychologist Dean Simonton. He's at University of California at Davis. And this is defined as an experience which pushes people outside of the realm of normalcy, helps them see the world in multiple ways, and that aids cognitive flexibility necessary for coming up with creative ideas. What are these diversifying experiences? A lot of them are multicultural experiences. So living abroad for a period, being exposed to multiple cultures, identifying with two cultures at once. One recent study found that people who identify with two cultures simultaneously have been shown to be more creative, more innovative, more professionally successful. Having students just remember a time they lived abroad actually made them better creative problem solvers. I don't know if anyone knows the... maybe I'll bring it up in questioning. It's a very particular... functional fixedness, this is... Anyway, it's a particular... in inventing, we fixate on a certain function of an object. So the classic example is, you know, people come into... And I'm blanking on the... on the psychologist who ran it, he's very famous. You come in and you see a box of tacks and candles, and you're supposed to put the candle on the wall and light it so that the wax doesn't drip on the floor. And because the tacks are in the box, you don't understand that you can pour the tacks out and pin the box to the wall and put the candle in it. So we're associating, we're thinking of box of tacks as one object. So that's functional fixedness. And just the reason I bring it up quickly is just thinking about having spent time abroad, lived abroad, made people better at solving that problem, which I think is remarkable. Pairs of two on problem solving. Carl Dunkner, 1925. Pairs of two who worked more creatively together when both had high levels of multicultural experiences, exposing people to an American and Chinese cultures in one study, made people more creative 7 days later, and that was explained by a higher comfort with ambiguity. One researcher who's worked on a lot of this is Adam Galinsky. I'm almost finished. He's a social psychologist at Columbia. They did a great study last year where they looked at 11 years of fashion brands, and they looked at the top executives and whether the executives had traveled abroad more. And the more they had traveled abroad, the more creative their fashion lines were. There was an interesting caveat, which is that it depended on the cultural distance of the country they were living in. So if the cultural distance was too far, that is, it was, you know, it's like a soldier who's going to Iraq, it's just too far, you don't immerse yourself in the culture. And of course, if it's too close, it's not different, it's not ambiguous, it's not stimulating your imagination. And actually, there was a New York Times article recently that showed that heterogeneous groups were better at pricing hypothetical stocks. Diversity makes you brighter. That was a fun piece. You see this historically, too. Simonton has actually looked at the history of Japan in 20-year intervals, and he measured outside influences, how many immigrants, how much travel abroad, whether natives were influenced by outsiders. And 40 years later, that was related to much higher creative outputs. So this is, you know, the idea that periods of artistic production, like New York City in the 1970s, occur during eras of social turmoil. You may think of Orson Welles' line in The Third Man, that Switzerland had brotherly love for 500 years and they made the cuckoo clock. And in Italy, you had the Borgias and Warfare and Terror, but they had Michelangelo and Da Vinci. So is there a set of rules by which uncertainty leads to creativity rather than dogmatism? I think it leads to both. Obviously, it's a personality issue or a choice in some sense. There is one interesting answer, which is not in the book, but I thought I would end with, which is in this great book by Ben Goetzel. He's the son of a family who wrote 300 Eminent Personalities. This was a study. They took 300 famous people, famous scientists, famous artists, and they tried to find what the common threads were. And they found two. One is that they, among artists and scientists, these famous artists and scientists, they develop a habit of carrying out some creative activity early on. And the two, which is the punchline, is they have an emotional or situational need to withdraw from the world into their own universe. So I think that one of the, creativity is a spillover effect, just like dogmatism is a spillover effect of uncertainty. And when uncertainty, these kind of extra energy from contradictions and uncertainty, don't find social expression for people who are loners, they may go home and or they go to the laboratory and do a science experiment or go home and paint or whatever their outlet is.
Excellent. Jamie, thank you very much. Maybe I could just sort of kick things off with a few questions, and then it would be wonderful to hear from our colleagues about ways in which ambiguity would be useful to our work here. Mm-hmm. Because when you're dealing with sort of high-stakes human rights issues, people's lives are at stake. Can ambiguity at any point actually be useful, or is it just the idea of even thinking about contradiction or anomalies ultimately putting people at risk? But I just want to throw out a few things. First, how American is all this work? I think from what I heard, only the non-American that was like maybe the Nazi in the beginning. So I'm wondering to what extent you feel a lot of the ideas generated in your research might be considered to be very much a product of not America, than a kind of broader sort of global North or Western mindset, or not, or if you feel there's something more universalist about it. And the other thing I wondered, in the book you sort of mentioned the Fukuyama example, who wrote that famous piece in the late 80s on the so-called end of history, and the problems with teleology, the problems with having some kind of preordained endpoint. We face that problem here, because for us the telos point is open society, and while we accept that there are bumps along the way, how could we not at this point, there still is ultimately a kind of a linearity and an intolerance for forms of ambiguity that stand in the way. So I'm just wondering at a broad level, and then we can get into more specific examples, what would you tell an institution like the Open Society Foundations that does have a framework that has a direction to it and a purpose to it and an intolerance for things that might stand in its path, how we might potentially think differently or be open to forms of contradiction alike?
Yeah, I think one of the... So, to your first question, the need for closure is a content-free construct. So Kruglensky has measured various cultural differences. There are some. They're not extensive. Because it's so closely tied to our need to manage complexity, it's universal. There are cultures who that are more comfortable with ambiguity, but the way I think of it is that's where they end. In the same way that you decide not to decide, you stop there. It still means you're closing your mind. You're ending with a formulation that may be more ambiguous. So I think it's, and Kruglensky would say that this is universal. The ideas in the book are universal. And he's now testing various countries. He has some preliminary data back on Italy and Belgium, and they're not extensive differences culturally. In terms of how does a culture, do better at dealing with ambiguity, I get the question a lot, and I got it a lot when I was promoting the book, is what do I do? How do we fix this? The more I learn about psychology, the more hesitant I am to put it into a to-do list, but I have some answers. One thing is that there are certain jobs in which you want to have people who are good at dealing with ambiguity. I would guess that an organization like this, it's because of the intercultural aspect, it's important. Negotiators, diplomats, intelligence analysts, entrepreneurs, I think politicians. There was a medical researcher who said we should put it on the MCAT because a lot of medical decisions involve handling ambiguity. The way that psychologists lower people's need for closure, make them better at dealing with it, is by reminding them of the consequences. So they say, right before they're about to make a decision, you're going to be accountable some way for this decision, or I'm going to compare your decision to an expert's decision or, you know, your decision is going to affect someone's life, so you better think carefully about it. So you could find ways to build those kinds of reminders into your decision-making process. The main thing that I take away from it is it's not a single decision point. So it's not like you're facing ambiguity once. You're facing it a lot. And that what you want to do is remain flexible. You want to be able to change your mind. I think there's a paradox where, and I touched on this a little, where in times of ambiguity, especially when something is changing very quickly, we have a strange preference or this natural preference for certainty. So I think this came up after 9/11. We could explain Donald Trump in some way according to this logic. And so at the very times, you know, sometimes it's a threat, but sometimes it's because things are changing very quickly. So in that context, you want a leader who's calm, who's willing to change their mind, who's going to be flexible, and who's going to, you know, not just stick to one decision. And yet, the impulse that we have is to look for leaders who have certainty, which in that context is going to be false certainty.
Could you ever imagine in that case a politician being at a political debate, hearing someone's argument, national TV, saying, I never thought of it that way. I actually agree with that. Could that mean, I mean, I'm just, yeah. It's hard with politicians, but just the last thing I just want to say, speaking of MoMA, I remember going to an exhibit with my wife of Mark Rothko's, a prominent American modernist at MoMA, in which they sort of totally subverted the linearity of his art. So instead of like finished, he committed suicide in 1970. And so like his last sort of triptych paintings were deeply dark and, you know, morose and very painful to look at. Beautiful, very painful. But everyone, you know, you make this argument about people's late style. Well, of course, that was Rothko at the end. So what they ended up doing, MoMA, which is rare for MoMA, it's not a very radical institution, but they completely flipped around the periodicity so that, you know, you had sort of late Rothko in the beginning and the like. David Bowie, we've been thinking a lot about recently. Bowie, of course, who died 2 days ago, 69. Mm. You know, we look at his last record now as, because we think in this teleology, of course it's his late style, he's dead, he's dead. You know, how does one, post-structuralist, I thought, one of the great advantages of that period was really flipping around narrative and forcing us to recognize that, you know, one's late style should not be seen as somehow, you don't want to reify it, that people's styles are constantly moving and changing and fluctuating, and having a simple kind of beginning, middle, and end is sometimes corrosive to really understanding the life cycle of an object or a person or a movement or a theme. That we need to be much more comfortable in that. I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. In terms of the political comment, we have made changing your mind kind of, it can't be a good thing. It's like, oh, you're supposed to know beforehand, and so when a politician changes their mind, that's
flip-flop.
It's flip-flopping. Okay, well, what if it's flexibility? I think linear progress narratives are very dangerous and misleading. You see them in science a lot. The idea that, and it's almost a way in which we like to elevate the present moment over the past. So like we're, you know, look what we've done, look what science has given us. And I think there's an overemphasis on quantitative methods, which is part of that. And what's being painted is a linear narrative in which we're moving towards quantification of everything. And that's going to lead to people to ignore the other methods that people are, and also past thinkers. You know, one of the reasons why I end the book with Chekhov is I'm partly protesting the idea that, like, all good ideas are new. Well, it looks like he had that idea quite a long time ago, and he expressed it in a short story.
Yeah.
We didn't need an experiment for it. Now, these things can be complementary, and in the book they are. But, so...
That was nice.
Oh, thank you.
That was nice.
He's my hero.
Yeah, I love Chekhov, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just open it up to everyone, Washington and New York. Minsk.
I just want to confirm that everyone knows Mark Rothko is from Belarus originally.
Oh, that's right.
Tiny is from Belarus. Wait a second. No, Mark Rothko's not from Belarus.
He's from Lithuania.
No,
I mean,
he's
from Latvia.
No.
Wait a second. What's his face? Yeah. Who's the guy who did the kitschy murals?
We'll get to
Chagall.
Chagall. Chagall's from Vitebsk.
Oh, there's only one famous artist from Belarus.
All right, let's get back on point.
Amy will talk.
Okay.
Andy Warhol's from Slovakia, right?
Yes, please. Chris.
So,
this is Chris.
Chris. I guess two quick questions. Firstly, I wonder, are there differences in how this framework or this model applies at an individual, organizational, and societal level? Because it seems like as if you laid out, obviously very briefly, yeah. You kind of jumped between those, and I wonder if there are important differences in how that applies at those different levels that one should be aware of, that also sort of points to different takeaways that one should have when thinking about this at different levels. Also, I guess I also wonder, sort of a corollary to this notion of how individuals and organizations and societies also think about ambiguity is how what role risk takes in that, right? So I guess I just wonder, and perhaps it's something, in the book and elsewhere you get into more detail, but, to what degree that discomfort with ambiguity also has consequences for how decisions are made relative to risk. And that's also something I feel like here at Open Society, when we're making decisions, we're constantly trying to wrestle with, and also how to represent risk to other decision makers at different levels within an organization, and the tendency to perhaps minimize or misrepresent risk either to ourselves or to others. And you're defining risk as a decision where there are no nods?
Well, I guess there's different levels to that, right? But I would say here, actually, we deal oftentimes in situations in which there's uncertainty, even about the uncertainty to a degree.
So the famous distinction between risk, and that's why I ask about how you define it, is the Ellsberg experiment or thought experiment. In which, so he's defining risk as it's a decision where the odds are known. So you have a jar and you have 50 blue balls and 50 red balls, and you know the mix, versus a jar where you have 100 and there's some unknown mix. Yeah. And what he was showing was, even though to our knowledge they're identical, we don't like the unknown mix. And in fact, our dislike for the unknown mix is irrational, leads us to irrational decisions. I argue that I use that example, and I think a lot of economists will say that this is all rationally calculated, but a lot of the decisions, even if we could find out the precise odds, we don't, and we don't know them. So we're acting as if there's a lot of cases in which We're acting as if there's more information either that is possible to get or that we have at the time. And that's leading to aversion away from those kinds of decisions. In terms of the organizational question, there's a psychologist who looks at it in much more depth, or sociologist, I think he is, than I do. Marsh, he's got like 2 or 3 books on organizational theory and ambiguity. The only distinction that I look at really in depth in the book is the one I laid out, and it is identical. That is, the individual reacts, The idea is to the individual when the person is thinking about it. The dissonant idea, which is rejected in a group setting, is the dissonant person who is marginalized and rejected.
Cool. Yes, please. Please introduce yourself.
Sorry, Kitty, Public Health Program. Not OSF related, but comments, questions, the connection of kind of this idea of ambiguity with the growth mindset and Dweck's research, and also this sense of ambiguity and decision fatigue, because in the, like, this area of ambiguity, you work with contingency plans and you're constantly trying to come up with decisions that you'd make in different contingencies, in turn leading to decision fatigue, which I guess gets, I mean, there's a lot of research on how that inhibits in some ways, or lowers your tolerance to make proper decisions at some point. So
yeah,
somehow work related, but you know, in this sense of, I totally understand the need for some ambiguity, but how do you balance that with decision making fatigue, which in turn can be a consequence of ambiguity because you're constantly thinking of contingency plans in an ambiguous situation of sorts. Sorry, it's a bit of a...
No, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to understand the...
Okay, I see DC.
Yeah.
DC.
Yep.
Did you want to get in on this question, Washington, specifically?
No, it's another one.
Okay. Is that Lucia?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Lucia.
There's a paper I will point you to.
Yeah.
So there's a paper by Eva Jonas, 2014, in which they explicitly address the relationship of their work on ambiguity and uncertainty to the willpower research. Mm-hmm. This is Roy Baumeister's work. It's actually how I got interested in this topic. And they argue that he has just reframed cognitive dissonance research. And that one of the problems in psychology is that because there's a demand for novelty, you have encouraged people to rename old phenomena. So I would just point you to that paper.
Okay. Good. And on the mindset, growth mindset?
Yeah, Dweck's work. Remind me of what that is. Is she on talk about grit? Or that's Duckworth.
Yeah, well, it's connected to grit, like the idea that you need kind of a growth mindset, that it's more beneficial to have a growth mindset than a fixed mindset.
And what's and a
it's
growth the mindset?
The growth mindset is that you are open to new ideas and open to ambiguity and kind of open to a challenge rather than knowing that you want to solve something that you've already.
Right. No, there is openness to experience.
Yeah.
There's a literature on that which is related to tolerance of ambiguity, and one of the scales in Need for Closure is about open-mindedness, but I don't know.
Okay, Tirta, hang on a second, we'll go to Lucy and then Tirta. Yeah.
Okay, so hello, I'm Lucia, I'm an Open Society Fellow here in the Washington office now, and I am researching on something that I called solid organizations in a liquid world. So it's how rights-based groups are adapting to a liquid and more complex society. And I have two questions for you. One of them is about how new do you think this ambiguity is? I mean, it's more visible today that we are a complex and ambiguous world, and why? Or this has always been there? If your book was published 300 years ago, this would be the same. Do we have more access to ambiguity today that we used to? So about what's different today, and if this difference has something also to do with talking more about mindfulness, presencing, theory U, and all the stuff that tries to keep us in this moment and with short term answers and so. Second question, I think it's more or less what Lenny was asking on, how do we embrace ambiguity and continue to promote values that are like dogmas, such as human rights? Because I feel that every time I try to bring challenges that are questions and not answers on how to do it differently, human rights defenders, including me, start to fear that by embracing complexity, they will lose their values. They will be weaker in promoting values that are non-negotiable, that are principles, that are not subject to any kind of ambiguity. You cannot admit that maybe torture in this case was right, there is an ambiguity there. So how do you relate value and ambiguity? Thank you.
Sure. I think, of course, it's always been there. There are ambiguity has always been, you know, something we've struggled to deal with. I think that the communication platforms that we're using, it's certainly been very disruptive to the business world. I think socially and culturally, the world is a lot smaller, and there's a lot more contradictory information. So there's a study
that was done last year on, they had people read contradictory blog posts on vaccine efficacy, and that contradiction polarized people's views, as I was saying. So I think some of the overwhelming nature of the internet and having culture so close together is responsible for polarization. You know, in the last, in the United States, the last 10 years have been the most politically polarized on record. So I would say, you know, the cultural ambiguity and the role of technology has exacerbated the problem. In terms of the value question, which is a really interesting question, because I thought about it a bit, I almost think that whenever you exit the world of morality and try to accomplish something, that problem comes up. I'm not sure how you deal with it. We were talking about Chekhov, and he talks about that a lot. And he has actually a wonderful story called An Artist's Life. And he was a philanthropist, you know, so he built schools and he was tending to the sick. And The Artist's Life is all about how you could, it was about a landscape painter who wanted to do nothing but go and paint landscapes. And I think it was a profound contradiction or struggle that he had his entire life, is that you can be over here and you can have this beautiful idea and this beautiful theory, but you know that is kind of, you can't have that same purity when you're trying to do something and you have to compromise. So, I mean, I don't have a solution to it. I think it's a very interesting tension. And I think it's in Obama's presidency as well. You know, he has this kind of writing style and this rhetoric and this belief, and then he, of course, was very compromising and willing to take these small steps. So I don't know if I can resolve that, but it is interesting.
So, yeah, Tirta and then Mike.
Just two short questions. One is, on the organizational level, are there exercises that one can do to become more
right,
comfortable with ambiguity?
Yes.
And then the second question, and maybe it's related, but maybe not, so I'm not asking it. You mentioned as one of the side effects or accompanying traits of living comfortably with ambiguity is being able to see justification in both sides, and I don't know if you could say a bit more about that.
Yeah. So in terms of exercises, I mentioned this, the way they do it in experiments, which is being very deliberate before you make a decision. There are a few other things which make us more comfortable with ambiguity. One, or that has been shown in experiments. One is reading fiction.
Especially Chekhov.
Actually, I think there is a study.
Or reading material, Chekhov.
Not forward.
As opposed to...
I'm asking at the organizational level. That would help.
Start
with some.
Well, so, you know, people who read fiction then temporarily have a lower need for closure. Why is that? I think it's because fiction is safe. It's a non-threatening activity, and you're entering the mind of other characters. Another thing which has been shown to make us more comfortable with ambiguity is thinking about multicultural experiences and having multicultural experiences. There's a great 2012 experiment which showed that, you know, they had people write about the time they'd lived abroad, friends they'd met from different cultures, diverse musical or culinary experiences that lowered their need for closure, and similar interventions made them less discriminatory and they had a lower tendency to stereotype. And both these things, multicultural experiences and reading fiction, make us more empathetic. In terms of how lasting those effects are, I don't know. The fiction experiment was, the effect was stronger for people who are habitual readers. So if you do it a lot, get into the habit of it. Did you have a second part to the question?
If you can say a bit more about seeing the justification in both sides, is that something that you would suggest practicing? Again, I'm talking on the organizational level.
Yeah. You know, a lot of this is about your personal experiences, whether you see both sides. A lot of literature has focused on how you get people to stop stereotyping the outgroup. And there's a really great study that came out last year from Philipps University in Germany. It's a meta-analysis. And they looked at the effects of intergroup contact, so spending time with the outgroup. whatever that, you know. So in Arizona, they would have people spend time with immigrants. And it would be an orchestrated meeting, and it would be a structured intergroup discussion with dialogue. And so this meta-analysis looked at things like that, but also virtual contacts with other groups. And it turns out that these are really strong effects, that they really help people see both sides of an issue. It lasts over time. It reduces prejudice. It even works in high-intensity conflict areas.
Is there anything counterintuitive about any of that, though?
Probably not. Probably not. No. I mean,
I think
what's
counterintuitive is seeing ourselves as maybe not having that kind of... committed to others,
yeah.
Right?
The stuff about very subtle stressors and how easily we're thrown off by things we're not even aware of. I think that's not...
Yeah, I mean, I think that it works in high-intensity conflict areas. It would surprise me. I think how lasting the effects are would surprise me, that it works in all different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And it also extends to other outgroups. So, you know, I'm sitting with an immigrant, whatever. I have that positive experience. That makes me more willing and more open-minded about other groups, even beyond the group that I was in the intervention with. And there was one other thing I was going to say, but I can't remember.
Okay, maybe we'll just Mike.
Mike from the scholarship program. I'm curious what the impact of language is, specifically high context versus low context languages, and whether or not that has, or culturally that makes a difference in terms of how people deal with ambiguity.
A high context?
So English would be high context, right? Or a language that uses specific examples to describe what you're doing. So you have. The counterexample is Thai,
right.
Where you don't have gender, you don't have past, present, future in the same way.
Yeah, there is some good work. There's a book, Craig Glansky's best book on this is called The Psychology of Closed-Mindedness. And he does have a section there on cultures which tend to be more comfortable with ambiguity and it finds expression in language. Where I fell on that was, well, that's just your endpoint. You know, you're still closing. Are you really exploring it if you're just kind of like, well, it's there. You know, you decide not to decide. You're kind of. So I think it's more of a cultural norm as expressed in language, but it doesn't undercut to me the need to reduce.
Yes.
Hi, Alexandra from the Fellowship Program. I have a question also on this cultural aspect. And essentially, I'm just thinking about, for example, you're saying this is a universal situation. So then when you have, for example, a society, you know, Chinese society, Chinese educational system, which is constantly telling people, sort of encouraging, like the education system is entirely, bound up in this idea of, you know, supporting decision-making and answers and not, you know, wrestling with ambiguity, where that is kind of like a nature versus nurture question a little bit, like sort of how that factors in, where if, you know, people are encouraged their entire life to be close to this ambiguity and to increase the sort of, you know, decision-making, their abilities.
Yeah.
How you see that?
I mean, I think that the most interesting aspect of this is, which is why I like the need for closure, is the situational factors which affect it. And part of that is culture. And part of that is threat. So I think, you know, the way in which I go back to after 9/11. How was the collective need for closure raised? And how did we react as a group? And what were the consequences of that? There's a great study that showed that people's approval of Bush, you know, went up and down with the color-coded threat warning. But also, the Americans' approval of the economy went up and down with the threat warning. So it's completely unrelated. And it shows that you can raise or things raise our intolerance of ambiguity on a collective level, and we have less room for ambiguity in general. And one of the things that, you know, that can nurture that is that kind of environment.
So, but is that then, I mean, that like endpoint, or is there still, you're saying? I guess I'm wondering, like, if that's a particular situation, but that situation is ongoing.
Oh, I see. How lasting would that be?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Personality.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I looked at, I did ask about how this works over the lifespan. There hasn't been much research on it, there hasn't been anything on that question. But it does turn out that adolescents are more tolerant of ambiguity. and they rather than
but you don't want them to because you want them to follow rules.
Well, rather than the counterpoint is, oh, they're just more risk taking. They're wild, and the research that I like on this says that's not what's happening. They're programmed to be exploring early on, and yeah, you're gonna like some people will die, but you'll figure out the new environment, right? The next generation will figure out the new environment, and then that hardens. This is like fast, cheap, and out of control. What is it?
Any other questions or comments? Stephen? Steve Hubble from the Fellowship.
Yeah, Steve Hubble from the Fellowship Program. Now that we've got some guidelines on how to mitigate the drift toward the need for closure in our own lives, much of what we do as an organization is confront entities that have raised the need for closure to a kind of institutional high art and overriding priority, nationalist organizations, paramilitary organizations, governments that are closing civil society space. Mm-hmm. Our default approach, or one of them, is to weave narratives that introduce complexity and ambiguity. I think we have, it's safe to say, a mixed experience with that, about whether telling the stories of Roma communities in Eastern Europe mm-hmm. has had anything, has it had the positive outcomes that we see. In many cases, it may have had the effect of reinforcing some of the closure-seeking behavior that is the origin of the problem in the first place.
Is our
misstep in assuming that these counter-narratives can be the antidote to closure-seeking behavior? Or is it that we are trying to approach people as individuals when they don't see themselves as having taken an individual decision to seek closure, but rather an individual decision to join a group, and that group has as one of its unifying cohesive elements closure seeking?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think so. So Kurt Lewin, this was father, one of the fathers of social psychology, says, in order for group behavior to change, or some opinion, it has to first become unstable. So a certainty has to pass through uncertainty, and that it, rehardens as something else. I think that's one of the reasons why narratives and arts and film can change people's minds, because it's unthreatening. And it draws you into a narrative and it almost surprises you into changing your mind. I don't know how exactly this is done on a programmatic level, but one of the things that could keep that from happening is if the message is perceived as coming from an outgroup or is perceived as threatening in any way. So I think that the concept, I think, is right, but it has to be delivered in a way which is probably from an in-group member in a non-threatening way, and I don't know if that's what I would say.
Any other questions or comments?
Hello?
Yes, someone on the phone. Yes.
Yes, hi. This is Martha.
Oh, hi, Martha.
Hi, Lenny. Hi, everybody else. I had a couple of questions. Jamie, I'm Martha Lurkey. I'm the director of the scholarship programs at OSF. And so, of course, I was delighted to hear such a strong plug for multicultural experiences.
Thank you.
The selection process is rife with ambiguities, but at least perhaps we can be certain or confident that the experience itself is a positive benefit, which always suspected. Anyway, My question is, has there been any disaggregation of the types of contexts within which an individual is more or less comfortable with ambiguity? And if there has, it seems to me that that could be then quite a useful tool, getting back to Lenny's earlier point of how do we use this concept. That's a great management tool, then, if you can, with staff, sort of help people or help to understand as a manager when people on your team are going to, tend to be more dogmatic or not, or when they're going to be more comfortable your own level of ambiguity. And I just wonder, has that type of analysis been done for the contextual differences for comfort levels with ambiguity? And my second question, and it's not really a question, it's just something that I am, I would say, highly ambiguous and uncertain about. Does this have implications for how we conduct evaluation or impact assessment of our work? And I, it's a poorly formed question because I can't even get at it, but I think there is something here, particularly in the world of individual grant giving, when the outcomes are so so ambiguous.
Right.
Thanks.
Sure. So I touched on a little earlier some of the contextual things that make people less able to deal with ambiguity. If you're rushed, if you're stressed, if you're tired, so if you're on deadline, that's going to be a time where people are going to be thinking more rigidly. And then in a group setting, again, if you have a person in that group who is, you know, who tends to be more certain and more dogmatic, they can kind of, you know, this is, again, isn't this obvious? They can bully the person off, you know, engaging with ambiguity and being more flexible. One of the reasons why in negotiations, what they're doing now out in, where is it, Montana, with this group who's they're letting them even come and go from the ranch. It's like, please go buy soda and chips and come back. And the reason they're doing that is because they found out that that's what works. Lower the need for closure. Don't dress up in uniforms. Let them come and go and wait them out. And they learned that from the opposite tactics not working, which was Waco and Ruby Ridge. I would say protect people who have to deal with ambiguity and who are exploring it and who remain flexible from those other group members. To your evaluation question, it's a really interesting question. It's actually something I'm working on now separately. I would look at the literature on construct validity, and it's really about how, when you're doing evaluations, you know you're measuring what you want to measure. A funny example that an evaluator who was former president of the American Evaluation Association told me. There's a study where they're deinstitutionalizing people coming out of a mental health facility and putting them back, reintroducing them into society. And they said, okay, well, we're going to give people jobs and we're going to give them a mobile health worker. And they polled people as to how well they thought they would do, and everyone thought it would be great. And it turned out the predictions were highly correlated with how people actually did, but they were negative. And they looked at why this could be, and they looked at the qualitative notes. And the qualitative notes were that people hated their jobs. So they gave them really crummy jobs. So it shows that you can't think of give person a job in an abstract sense. I think a lot of evaluation, problems in evaluation, especially in social policy, come from measures that haven't been thought through well enough or that are hard to measure. Some are much harder to measure than others. So I think it's a major issue. It's a really interesting question.
Thank you,
yeah.
Martha.
Mike, just very quickly, my question on different contexts was not about situational context, but if there was a difference in, so I can feel ambiguous and comfortable with ambiguity with certain content, but in other content areas, like as somebody else was talking about, when your values get challenged, where you might tend towards more dogmatism and other types of content or challenges might allow you to be a lot more flexible.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I'm sure those exist. I'm not aware of that research, but you must be right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you.
For all your words of wisdom and your really fine book, and congratulations on it. Nonsense. And thank you all very much. Darius, thank you for co-hosting this. We have to do this again. And thank you all very much.